for everyone who loves books. This is Read On.
Hello, I'm Derek Jacobi and you're listening to RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sail, and coming up in today's show, Sir Derek Jacobi reflects on a lifetime of bringing characters to life off the page.
I enjoy the audiobooks. You don't have to look your best for a start. You can do it in your pyjamas with a cup of coffee beside you, you know.
Tony Hawks reveals how he ended up playing the Moldovans at tennis.
He said, all right, I bet you couldn't beat the entire Moldovan team. They won't have managers and agents. And what's more, if you do beat them, I'll strip naked on Balamai Road and sing the Moldovan national anthem.
Regina Regan talks about Tales of the City, Rosemary's Baby, and cakes.
It's such a wonderful way to first ingratiate yourself with people, and then you become indispensable because they need your baked items.
That's all coming up on today's Read On. Sir Derek Jacobi is one of the outstanding actors of his generation, a star of stage, screen, and audiobooks. He's recently celebrated his 80th birthday and, although he's still as busy as ever, he invited me over to chat about his glittering career. We began by talking about the part that brought him into millions of people's living rooms, the lead role in the BBC's 1976 adaptation of I, Claudius.
When Claudius came along, I'd been an actor for 16 years by then. I started in 1960 at the Birmingham Rep. And when Claudius came along, I'd had over 7 years at the National Theatre with Sir Lawrence. But Claudius got me kind of pumped into people's sitting rooms over the course of 6 months. And so my doting parents could actually talk to the neighbours about me, and the neighbours would know who I was. Because up until then, they thought the National Theatre was like the National Coal Board or something, you know. So Claudius, for my career, was a huge leap forward for me.
It was a fantastic role. I mean, he was in virtually every scene and one of the great schemers in political history.
One of the great schemers and one of the great survivors. Nobody thought he was worth any kind of notice. He was a very educated man. He was a very wily man, because he had to be. But he was very clever at it, and nobody really realised what a canny old man this was. They only saw the outward things. They saw the twitch and they heard the stammer and they saw the limp and, you know, and thought that then he really wasn't worth bothering about. But I didn't record the books of I, Claudius and Claudius the God until many years later. I don't think I'd done any audio recordings the recording of the television of I, Claudius, yeah.
Did you approach narrating the audiobooks in a very different way to acting the part?
In a sense, yes. I enjoy the audiobooks. You don't have to look your best for a start. You can do it in your pyjamas with a cup of coffee beside you, you know. But it is fascinating because I've always been very interested in the voice. I love doing radio because you have nothing else. They can't see you. They can only hear you. And so everything has to come vocally. The characters have to come alive through your voice. The scene setting has to be through your voice. And that is fascinating. And if you can, it's not easy. It's not easy. And sometimes I get it terribly wrong. There was one time, I won't tell you the author, he's very well known, but I'd been sent this particular book, it was fiction, to read, and it was so boring. I got about a third of the way through and thought, no, I'll wing it, I'll wing the rest. And I got to the studio and we were recording it, and we got quite a long way through it. And we suddenly realised that one of the characters was American. And I hadn't been doing an American accent. And But what saved me was the producer had also been bored stiff and had failed to do his homework. So we were both caught out because he hadn't realised either that this particular female character was American. But I survived.
I know many narrators mark up the book with different coloured pens for different characters and make notes in the flyleaf as to always sounds angry or has a very laconic voice. Do you do the same?
Not always, and that is also one of the jobs for the producer, because if you do go wrong and you miss something, the producer is there to say, put you on the right track, you know. No, I'm not a marker of books and a taker of notes. I also have, I was about to say a gift, it's not a gift, it's a knack of being able to sight read. I can read, for instance, I start a sentence and I don't know where the sentence is going, but I can, if I see halfway through the sentence that it's not going where I thought it was going, I am able to change inflection and tone to suggest that I knew all along what the sentence was going to end up as. It is a knack. It is a trick. But then all acting really comes into the category of knack or trick. It can be called a craft, it can be called a skill, it can be called an art, and it is all those things, but it's also trickery.
You've read a very large number of audiobooks, many, many different authors, from Tolkien to Michael Morpurgo to Arthur Conan Doyle. Does that knack work with all authors, or are there some who trip you up from time to time?
It works for most authors. It works for 90%, yes, yes. Because sometimes, you know, you are sent a book to read, and you really, and then they say, we need you next week. Well, you haven't got time sometimes to read the whole book. You kind of get a précis of what it's about and rely on the producer to fill you in. And also, this knack that I'm talking about, the sight reading, which comes in very useful. But yes, you're right. Different authors present different problems. And but they're not always problems. They're wonderful things. I am very... I get very emotional when I'm reading, and I tend to cry a lot, particularly if it's a very moving or upsetting piece. Certainly if it's about an animal who's dying, we will take hours in the studio because I can't cope, and I cry, and of course you can hear it. But I try not in that sense to get so involved that it harms the recording. You know, it's not about me getting upset. It's about the story and the people I'm trying to be.
One of the more recent books that I've listened to that you narrated was The House of Silk by Anthony Horowitz, yeah. The continuation of the Sherlock Holmes series. And actually, I picked up on your anger at the end of that. It was a very moving book. It was also a great mystery. I associate you now with the Sherlock Holmes series because you've read so many of them, yeah. And with the continuation. Are they books that you particularly enjoy?
Oh, very much, very much. I love a good mystery. They're well written. They're, for a reader, they're beautifully written. They're very easily written, you know. The knack of being able to switch mid-sentence is... you're very much accommodated by Conan Doyle to do that. No, I think all the stories are great. And all the characters are wonderful. And I enjoy that very much, very much. I think I've done most of the short stories, and it's lovely. We did them all, I remember, down in a wonderful studio down in Bath. So I'm down there for two or three days. And two or three days in Bath reading a book is, and getting paid for it, it's quite a good way to earn a living, really.
Are there any other authors who you relish getting the job to narrate?
There's not one particular author that I would relish. I love the variety. There is one author that I dread, and I've recently recorded one of his novels. It's a gentleman called Charles Dickens. I've just recently finished 1,000 pages of Martin Chuzzlewit. It took about 12 days to do this. It seemed endless. They sent me Dombey and Son, and I was the third of the way through that. But I can't do this. Life's too short. So I said, please, I don't want to do Dombey. Can you think of another one? Hoping that they choose something like Tale of Two Cities. They came back with Martin Chuzzlewit, which is a book I didn't know. And I said, yes, OK, we'll do Martin Chuzzlewit. It's long. It's over 1,000 pages. So we started, and I'd forgotten those Dickensian sentences. And there, indeed, you need your wits about you, because they are so long and there are so many parentheses that you start a sentence, you have no idea when it's going to end. And you have to work your way through it like a minefield. But what he is very good at is dialogue. And when you get to the scenes of dialogue between the characters, you emit a sigh of such relief that all the descriptive passages are silent for a moment. And that I find difficult, yes. It's low on the job satisfaction scale. It's an effort, and I'd rather it not be an effort. But what you remember at the end of the session is, oh, thank God it's over.
And at the other end of the scale, if I could offer you any book to narrate that you haven't already narrated, is there one that you would kill for?
There was one book that I longed to record, and it did eventually come my way. It was a book called Daughter of Time by Josephine Tay, which is all about Richard III, a policeman in hospital. His hospital bed is given, sent a card, and it's the picture, the famous picture of Richard III. And he does this big detective job from his bed. I loved that book, and eventually I was asked to do it.
And did you enjoy recording your own autobiography, as luck would have it, which is in the RNIB library?
No, I didn't. No, because I hadn't written it. I mean, it was ghostwritten, but I spent a lot of time with Gary O'Connor, who did write it. We were at university together many, many years ago. And we met up quite by chance, and we were having a drink in a pub, and he said, have you ever thought of writing your autobiography? And I said, no, I can't write. I prefer to read other people's. And he said, well, I've done a lot of biographies, particularly theatrical biographies. Would you like me to do it? It would mean, you know, we just talk and chat. And over the next 2 years, we talked and chatted. But I am afraid I displayed my initial lack of interest in it. So he would write, I would talk, and he'd go away, and then he'd come back and he'd send me proofs, and I'd flick through the proofs, not really with any great forensic interest. So when it was eventually published, there were some errors. There were some omissions, bad omissions. So when I was asked to read it, as I read it, I kept coming across, I'd forgotten he'd said that, or I'd missed that bit. And so it wasn't a totally pleasurable experience, but it was something that sort of had to be done, I'm afraid. Oh, dear.
And do you listen to audiobooks for pleasure yourself?
Occasionally. Occasionally in the car or something. But no, I love reading.
But you must be delighted that you are enabling so many people with a print disability to be able to enjoy the same books that you enjoy.
Oh, indeed, indeed. It's wonderful to be able to do that. And I also narrate a thing called Living Paintings, which are paintings that are done in a format that is raised so that you can follow the pictures with your fingertips while I am telling you what you're touching and who it is or the colour of it. And it's called Living Paintings, and I've done quite a few of those, and I love doing those, and they've been a big success.
Well, Derek Jacobi, thank you so much for opening my eyes to so much great literature over the years, and may you carry on narrating many, many more books in the future.
I will second that. I would love to carry on, because I do enjoy it, and it's wonderful that it helps others and entertains others, you know, and it's just a lovely part of being an actor.
It was all a ghastly mistake. The state of the world at that time was such that no one thought of having a family. Hitler was already advancing fast, and the world was on the brink of war. When I was born in East London on the 22nd of October 1938, this was in our front room in Leytonstone. My mum, Daisy, struggled in labour for 40 long hours to give birth. 40 hours. Has anyone ever taken so long to be born? It must be a record. Mum was completely worn out, and when at last I'd been delivered, she sank back and groaned, "Never again."
For a full list of titles narrated by Derek Jacobi, including his memoir, As Luck Would Have It, My Seven Ages, visit the library at rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. And Derek will be back at the end of the programme to share the books of his life. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Regina Regan on fried green tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe and why she will never enter the Great British Bake Off. But first,
a big supporter of RNIB is the comedian, actor and author Tony Hawks. I first met him in 2001 when he came into the Talking Book Studios to record a short story for the RNIB-produced book Sightlines, which, as an aside, is well worth tracking down in the RNIB library, as it features many exclusive short stories, some of which are read by the author or a celebrity narrator, such as June Whitfield, Frederick Forsyth, Jim Broadbent and indeed Tony Hawks. Sightlines, edited by P.D. James, is TB12555. Tony Hawks has also given me permission to play his books Round Ireland with a Fridge, One Hit Wonderland and Playing the Moldovans at Tennis on the Talking Book Show on RNIB Connect Radio. And it was the latter that we chatted about when he popped into the studio, just when the film of the same name was coming out.
I have to beat the entire Moldovan national football team at tennis, one by one.
You are very optimistic.
It's always a good idea to have a visual picture of what your challenge is.
This is the list of the players that you need to play.
Sounds easy. Should be out of here within the week.
And Tony Hawks joins me now. Now, this was your second book, and as with Round Ireland with a Fridge, it started as a bet.
It did, yeah. It's a bizarre story, really. We were watching England play Moldova in the World Cup qualifiers on the TV, myself and my friend Arthur Smith. I'd been playing tennis, so I was sitting there in tennis kit. Out of the blue, he just said, "I don't reckon you're that good at tennis, Tony. I don't reckon you could beat. I don't reckon you could beat all those footballers we're watching." And I said, "I thought I could, because footballers aren't known for being very good at tennis." And we got into a genuine argument about this, and he said, "Look, I bet you couldn't beat them." And I said, "It's a silly bet. I'd never be able to play the England players. They'd never agree to play me. They've got managers, agents. I'd never be able to reach them." He said, "All right, I bet you couldn't beat the entire Moldovan team. They won't have managers and agents." And And what's more, if you do beat them, I'll strip naked on Balham High Road and sing the Moldovan national anthem. And so I thought, well, this sounds like an adventure. I think I was I'd done Round Island with a fridge. I'd had an amazing time. It was a very interesting thing to go off and do something quite wacky and silly. And this appealed to me, you know, the idea of going to a country I knew nothing about. We had to look it up on the map to see where it was. And then and go with this challenge, you know, to track down the 11 footballers that had played in this match and ask them to play me at tennis. And the adventure began like that.
Now, to find out if you did it or not, you're going to have to listen to the book. But Arthur Smith, I believe, laid some traps for you along the way.
Yes, it wasn't all as his behaviour lacked dignity, one might say. Without giving too much away, after a very, very sticky start, things started to go better. And then there was a certain amount of subterfuge that took place, and I don't want to say too much, because as you mentioned, it can spoil it. But you'll have to listen to find out what it is that happens.
Now, at the start of this journey, did you think it would have such a philanthropic effect on you, which is lasting to this day?
Not at all, no. I mean, I went there, you know, hoping to have a big adventure, fun adventure, and write a book about it. I did, you know, unlike Round Island with the Fridge, where I just went on this sort of whim and the story emerged, it became a book. This one I was commissioned by publishers, and so it was almost like my job for that period of time to go and track down footballers. But when I got there, I ended up with a sort of moral dilemma, because Moldova was then and is still the poorest country in Europe. I saw a lot of poverty, I saw a lot of people suffering, and I felt like the people I'd stayed with, the two doctors who were lovely people, hadn't been paid for 6 months. People were sitting on the streets selling things like, you know, one item of clothing or just a fish that they'd caught. And I hadn't really been close, particularly in Europe, to that kind of poverty. And I thought, God, this is difficult because, you know, what am I doing? I'm swanning in here as this relatively super rich Westerner. I'm going to get my story and I'm going to go back to UK and profit from it. So I made a decision, you know, almost thinking, well, that there's only one way to make this fair, and that would be to share whatever royalties I get with Moldova in some way. So all the royalties from the book have always gone into a fund, and it's been split 50-50 between me and a trust fund for Moldova. And fortunately, the book did well enough for us to buy a property. I went back to the doctors and said, look, I've got this money, what can we do with it? And they said, well, we need to open a centre for kids with cerebral palsy. We get them all referred to us and we can't do anything for them. And the state at that time just said, you've got to put them in a home. We'd like these families to be able to keep their children. So we set up this care centre, and it's been going on for 10 years now. I've made a film, and we're going to give the profits of that, all the profits of that, to this care centre. So it's an ongoing thing.
One thing I wondered about the film, why did Arthur Smith become Stephen Frost?
Ah, very good point. Well, Arthur, I don't know whether you've met him or know him, but he certainly appeared a few times on a programme called Grumpy Old Men.
Mm.
And he's got really good at it. And I phoned him up and asked him if he'd like to play himself in the film. And I got him on a morning when he was particularly grumpy. And he said, I can't be bothered, Hawks. I've too much on my plate. Can you get someone else? I can't be bothered. He just couldn't be bothered, really. I think he'd had a bad... But whether I'd chased him and really pushed him, he would have done it. I think I probably could have persuaded him. But it was a project where I thought, well, if you don't want to do it, don't do it. I don't want to sort of have to bully you. And I rang Steve, and he's from the same era, Stephen Frost. You know, he's an old mate of mine, and he's almost the kind of guy that would have done that. He was a fantastic substitute for Arthur. It was a great shame he didn't do it, but he also hasn't done a lot of acting, and although he's a fantastic comedian, Steve's done a lot more acting, and it may well have been that he didn't want to take that on either.
And not saying who, but is there any nudity at the end?
Aha, there is, but we have carefully shot it. It's mostly shot from the rear, and
as it were,
it's carefully done. It's tastefully done. Yeah.
All of Tony's books are available commercially in audio, Round Ireland with a Fridge, Playing the Moldovans at Tennis, One Hit Wonderland, A Piano in the Pyrenees, and his latest, Once Upon a Time in the West Country, all of which are read by Tony himself. Fridge, One Hit and Moldovans are available from RNIB, and the version of Moldovans, that's in the RNIB library, is read by Greg Wagland.
Alexandru, oddly assuming that I was some sort of authority on the game, asked me if I knew why tennis had such an unconventional scoring system. Yes, good question. This had been something which had always bothered me. Why 15? Why deuce? Why love? Advantage this, advantage that. Back in London, an afternoon in the library had done little more than reveal to me that no one is entirely sure, tennis being a very old game, which originated in France before people bothered to write things down much.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Tony Hawks. Playing the Moldovans at Tennis is one of many Tony Hawks books in the RNIB library. It's TB20094.
Hello, I'm Derek Jacobi, and... Oh, no, I've forgotten already! Say it again. Hello, I'm Derek Jacobi, and you're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Coming up later, Derek Jacobi gives us a tour of the books of his life. But before that, as regular listeners will know, RNIB Connect Radio's London studio is based in the Talking Book Studios in Camden. So I'm lucky enough to meet the authors and narrators who create our wonderful Talking Books library. And while I'm not supposed to have favourites, my next guest, for reasons that will become apparent, is always a welcome visitor. Regina Regan, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much, Red.
So I typed your name into the RNIB Talking Books Library and it came back with 85 titles. Can you remember your first book that you recorded for RNIB?
The first book I recorded was Sabrina the Teenage Witch, back when it was reel to reel and there was one producer for two studios simultaneously. So if you made a mistake, you had to wait until they could attend to your problem. So that was terrifying. So when we moved here to Camden, it was bliss.
So you must have seen a few changes over the years.
I have. Yeah, I mean, I think the studio is just fantastic. It's the production. I mean, people who listen will know, but the production values are just incredible. And I champion the RNIB and the Talking Books. And all my friends would tell you that her favorite place to work is the RNIB. Yes, she always says that. So, yeah, I guess I have seen changes, but all for the good, I think.
Is it less nerve-wracking now that, you know, it's digital recording, so people aren't having to physically cut tapes and stick them back together?
Well, that's sort of what I was referring to. When you're sitting there, when you make a mistake, you already are thinking, oh. And when you have to wait, because, you know, there's only one producer, one engineer for two studios running at the same time. You know, every time you make a mistake, you think, that's another 32 seconds, that's another 42 seconds. So, yes, it does. The fact that you can just, as we say, sort of fall back and pick up again so quickly, it minimizes the humiliation quotient. Still there, but minimized.
And you've recorded some fabulous titles, some real modern classics. The ones that always stick out for me are the Tales of the City books.
Oh, yes, I loved those. I was so genuinely thrilled when, I mean, to get one, but then to be asked to do the sort of series was just wonderful. I hadn't read the books, but I'd seen, there was a television sort of mini-series years before with Olympia Dukakis playing Mrs. Madrigal and Laura Linney. That was the first time I ever saw Laura Linney playing Marianne Singleton. So I have to admit, I did lift a bit from that, just from my memory, because they were so vivid and real, those creations, those characters. But no, I love doing those. Yeah.
Well, for me, it was one of those wonderful discoveries. I
lost my sight as far as being able to read was concerned after Baby Cakes, which I think was the third or fourth book.
Yes, I think it was. That's right.
So for me, you are the voice of Tales of the City. So, which is why I was so keen
have a little
to get
weep
you in
now.
Here.
Yeah. No, thank you. No, and you know, I've done a number of series. One of the ones that I love, if I could just mention it, is Janet Ivanovich's Stephanie Plum series. They're wild caper novels, and they're in the first person. So, even though I know she's written like 100 of them, I think I've done 5. But even though I know I'm not a 28-year-old bounty hunter from northern New Jersey, I feel like I'm now Stephanie. Like I have become Stephanie, and the cast of characters in that, because it is there's a cartoony element to it. So even though I keep Stephanie's voice quite normal and sort of like my voice, but a bit younger, you know, the characters around her are insane. So it's just fun to go a bit wild creating that world. And then, because I keep rather frightening amounts of notes and things, I can go back and say, oh, we've got Mrs. Carwatch. She's her neighbor. She's a low talker. So she's a low talker. She just talks really low and not, you know. So I just write little notes to myself. And then when I revisit characters and they return, I'm so happy.
Do you make notes that the low talker is somebody who you remember meeting in 1985 on a Brooklyn sidewalk? Or do the voices just come to you?
Sometimes I'd love to say, oh, I pull them from real, you know, you hear actors say, oh, I just sit in coffee shops and let voices drift over me. No, it's probably more likely that I might remember a role I did on stage a long time ago. But really, it's just, this is the way that I discover characters, if you like, if that doesn't sound too in quotes, is obviously the author gives us great clues, but sometimes they don't go into too much description about the character or, you know, even where they're from. So I look at the language of the character. Do they speak very rapidly? Do they give a lot away? Or perhaps they're very terse and the sentences are very short. And you can glean a lot from the attitude of the character, which is why I like to prepare so well. So I kind of know, are they being themselves? Are they afraid of revealing something? Are they trying to conceal? Or are they being quite effusive? Maybe they're nervous, maybe they're flirting, you know. So all those kind of little subtle things, that's how I sort of find the voice. Somebody who only speaks in very short sentences, I probably would give quite a sort of hesitant, careful voice, rather than someone who just babbles on like me. When I started, I used to do things that I now just roll my eyes at myself, if that can be possible, and think, oh, I used to, I think, impose a voice on a character.
So we've mentioned the way that things have changed, and of course one of the things that has changed is that you can now carry the script of a book on an iPad. Do you still mark up paper copies, or do you mark them up electronically now?
I have to confess, I still use paper. It's not because I'm a Luddite, but I get migraines from lights, and I had sort of a couple of bad experiences with devices and using it all day long. I will have to switch because now that's the standard format, particularly commercially. They send out PDF files, you know, and you use it on the, but so I have yet to tackle the markup on the iPad, but I completely mark up my manuscript, my A4.
And how did you come to the RNIB? What actually led you into the studios in the first place?
I wrote to them. I wrote and said that, you know, this is my experience, and came in, did an audition, and got Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and the rest is history. I always think that's one of the smartest things I did.
And bringing us right up to date, you were the narrator for Orange is the New Black, which, of course, is a huge hit on Netflix.
It is.
How did you find that? A woman 10 years after she committed a crime, living a perfectly normal life in the States, and gets sent to prison for over a year, and a hard women's prison at that.
Yeah, and the fact that it seems, when you see I've only seen like one episode of the Netflix, but you might assume that the novel is fiction, but it's not. And it reads as fiction, but it's actually written by, you know, the woman who was incarcerated. It's her story. Yeah, no, I think it's quite a remarkable book. The reason I remember that one is there were 47 prisoners. So that's 47 prisoner voices. That doesn't count all the people in the legal world and the prison wardens and, you know, everyone else. But yeah, so that was challenging. But she wrote some amazing characters.
Again, I associate you with another author, Jodi Picoult, who always writes a good psychological thriller, and you seem to get very much into those when you're narrating them.
Well, the interesting thing is sometimes she writes from first person perspective, and that's just something else I thought I would mention. Obviously, if you're doing a first-person subjective, and if it's I throughout the whole book, if it's just one character, then there's not much of a shift. But with Jodi, she often will have maybe four or five characters in a story, all with their own point of view. And if it's first-person, that's even more challenging, because I have to suddenly become the Asperger boy and his brother and his mother in different chapters. And really remember, if it's first-person, remember that narration voice throughout the chapter. So I'll do strange things like put little pink dots if it's the mother on the top of each page, just to sort of, in case I get a bit lost in my thoughts, it's like, yep, I'm still the mother. Because point of view, I think, is fascinating. It's one of the reasons I have incredible admiration for people who say, oh, I just read the book once and I kind of wing it. I like to discover it with the readers. I think, oh, that would make me so nervous, because I want to know. I like the shifts in point of view. I think it tells a lot about attitude and tone. You know, are we in the serial killer's mind, even though it's third person? So it's third person subjective. Third person subjective can be quite first person. If you have someone, say, berating themselves, let's say they go to a meeting with their boss and they leave and they sit in the car, they might say, she didn't know how she could have said that. What was wrong with her? That's not neutral. That's what I love, figuring out who's telling this section of the story.
And I know my producer, Robert, remembers you for having recorded the Little House on the Prairie series as well, which is that presumably, you know, books that you must have read when...
I grew up on those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, that must give you rather a nice warm feeling.
You know, I loved reading those because I remember, you know, reading about how they would... just the hardship that they went through. And, yeah, I loved Laura Ingalls Wilder. That was thrilling. There were a lot of illustrations in the book, which made me sad because we lost those. And there were also little snippets of songs. So I was sort of making up folk songs. And I think I amused Robert somewhat, because let's just say singing is not my strong suit. So the idea that Regina was composing and singing was pretty funny.
Now, not all the series that you get are serious literature. You seem to have read quite a lot of Mills and Boon books.
Have I? I have.
The Blaze Romances, I believe, which I know are very popular with R&IB library members. Are they fun to read?
They are. To be serious, the only problem that I ever have is if a book is well written, it's a joy to read. That sounds so obvious, but you can prepare it. But if, you know, sometimes there's a wonderful author, Shirley Jackson, who wrote the short story The Lottery, and I did The Haunting of Hill House. Sometimes her sentences, her descriptive sentences, would go on for 7 or 8 lines, but because they flowed so beautifully, they were easy to read. So as long as a book is well written, it's easy to read. The Mills and Boon they're fun. And some of the characters, I wouldn't say they're stock characters, but they're romantic characters that we want to identify with. So I might have my male, and I'll put a little heart next to him, my male heart voice. So he's like the heartthrob. He's the one that she has her heart's desire set on. Or I always think this book is, you know, take every book seriously. I would never send up a Mills and Boon because it's a romance novel. And there's something wonderful about it and something important about it to a lot of people. So I think they're very fun, and I hope that I managed to bring them to life with the joy and the sort of happy ending that they deserve.
And they're great escapism.
Exactly.
I think there's an awful lot of snobbery around, you know, what's literature and what's not. And the fact that Mills and Boon is as successful as it is means it reflects the fact that there are many, many thousands of people who are very happy reading them or having them read to them.
Exactly. So if I can bring that to life ever so slightly, then I've succeeded.
Do you ever squirm when they get a bit steamy?
I've been known to squirm. But you have to get over that, because if I wasn't comfortable reading one of the Blaze, Mills and Boon, I should say no. It's too late to be timid. If these people are falling into a passionate love affair and I'm going to hold back or make judgment on them worse, then I shouldn't be reading it.
Now, you are notorious for setting people's hearts racing whenever you come to the R&IB Talking Books studios.
Oh, I know what you're going to say. Baking.
Baking.
I have absolutely no illusions about my value. It is because I am a baker. I return places because I bake. I'm shameless.
You are not just a baker. You are a
No, but I'm teasing. But I mean, yes, no, I know. It's such a wonderful way to first ingratiate yourself with people, and then you become indispensable because they need your baked items.
Ever thought of going on to Bake Off?
Oh, no. No. No.
We'd all vote for you.
No. Oh, no. Oh, the standard now is so high. We're into patisserie land or, you know, it's beyond. No. I have enough trouble preparing a book and starting. Every time I start a book, I'm so nervous. And at the end, I have what I call last page-itis, where I want to end the book properly. And I get tongue-tied and nervous thinking, I have to sort of, I know how I want to do it. And, you know, so no. Can you imagine me in the tent? I'd be on the floor weeping.
As I say, you're not just popular for your cakes.
Well, particularly, the listeners are now thinking, oh, great, well, we don't even get the cakes. So, yeah, that's not very helpful.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, one of our regular listeners, Chris Gray, actually chose a book narrated by you as his hidden gem in the library. It was Water for Elephants, which I believe you narrated with William Roberts.
Oh, that's right.
A great tale of running away to join the circus.
Mostly Bill Roberts, though, I have to say. I didn't contribute that much. That's a tribute to Bill, but thank you, Chris.
Do you enjoy doing collaborative books? I noticed you've done Cloud Atlas.
Oh, I love it. Sometimes with a multi-voice narration, ideally there might be more, even with some of the Jodi Picoult, ideally there might be more than one narrator. But it's very difficult to coordinate five different people with their schedules, with the production schedule. You know, it sounds easy, but it's not. I love collaborating. Although, actually, we don't really collaborate. Although, I have emailed people, you know, sometimes just to say, what are you doing with that voice, or how far are we going with the accents, just so that we're all roughly in the same book.
Do you have a favourite book that you've narrated for RNIB?
One of them had to be a book I'd never read before, even though I'd seen the film, because it was quite a famous film, Rosemary's Baby by Ira Levin. And I absolutely loved it. Rosemary is quite controlled throughout the beginning. Well, she's quite excited in the beginning. You know, she starts out as a newly married, and they move into their dream apartment building and everything's going well. And just there's like, you know, perfect psychological horror, just a kind of drip, drip, drip of things going slightly askew, slightly wrong. Are they? Are they not? And I just absolutely loved doing it. And by the end, yes, I was going a little bit wild. But I thought, well, if you don't reach a crescendo with Rosemary, and not to give anything away, but let's just say satanic cult comes into it, then I think you're not doing a service to the book. So, yeah, I loved that one. And then another book that I loved, Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe by Fanny Flagg. Now, I did this quite a number of years ago, but it's a good example of, it's perfectly written for an unabridged audio, because I just have the book here, if I could just quickly give an example. Every single chapter head, it will say, The Whistle Stop Cafe, Whistle Stop, Alabama, March 22nd, 1933. So we always know where we are. And then there's also a little newsletter written by one of the local people who's so funny. Sometimes without italics, without a change in print, there are visual clues that tell the reader we're moving into a different area here, or maybe a different character voice. We don't have that. So I love the fact that this book was set up to be clear, and we all know where we are in Alabama or Georgia. And yeah, I just loved it.
Regina Regan, thank you ever so much for giving up your time to come in.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much, Red.
And I very much look forward to many more years of listening to your lovely voice and eating your wonderful cakes.
Fingers crossed on both counts.
I ran into Mr. Lasseter yesterday at the Ridgemont Mall, and he said the office is just falling apart with you gone. They don't get many good secretaries at Lasseter Fertilizers. Mom, that's sort of why I called. Yes, darling? I want you to call Mr. Lasseter and tell him I won't be in on Monday morning. Oh, Mary Ann, I'm not sure you should ask for an extension on your vacation. It's not an extension, Mom. Well, then why? I'm not coming home, Mom. Silence. Then, dimly in the distance, a television voice began to tell Mary Ann's father about the temporary relief of hemorrhoids. Finally, her mother spoke. Don't be silly, darling. Mom, I'm not being silly. I like it here. It feels like home already. Mary Ann, if there's a boy, there's no boy. I've thought about this for a long time. Oh, don't be ridiculous. You've been there for 5 days.
My guest, Regina Regan, reading Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin, which is TB14068. For a full list of titles narrated by Regina, search the RNIB Library website, rniblibrary.com, or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Do you have a favourite narrator you like to snuggle up with? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Why not drop us a line via the usual email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Now it's back to Derek Jacobi for the books of his life. And because it's nearly Christmas and he's such a voracious reader, I might have bent the rules a bit and let him have one extra. Derek, was there a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you fall in love with reading?
It did come late in my life, really, because I was an only child, East London, no books in the house. I never saw my parents read a book. Newspapers, yes, but not books. And it wasn't really until the age of 6 or 7 that a lovely lady came to live next door. She was a music teacher, and she gave me piano lessons and also took me to the local library. And I had vaguely read fairy stories, or I had been read too, but I hadn't read a great deal. And the library really opened a whole new world to me. I think in those days, the books that I loved were the Famous Five books, the Enid Blyton. I loved them. I loved all the kids in those. And then, of course, I went on to the Treasure Island and the great children's classics, which I loved. I was a late starter, but they were my first loves.
The three children stared at George in the greatest surprise. George stared back at them. "What do you mean?" said Dick at last. "Kieran Island can't belong to you. You're just boasting." "No, I'm not," said George. "You ask Mother. If you're not going to believe what I say, I won't tell you another word more. But I don't tell untruths. I think it's being a coward if you don't tell the truth, and I'm not a coward." Julian remembered that Aunt Fanny had said that George was absolutely truthful, and he scratched his head and looked at George again. How could she be possibly telling the truth? "Well, of course we'll believe you if you tell us the truth," he said. "But it does sound a bit extraordinary, you know. Really, it does. Children don't usually own islands, even funny little ones like that."
All of Enid Blyton's Famous Five books are available from the RNIB Library in a full range of accessible formats, including Five on a Treasure Island, narrated by Jan Francis. It's TB13524. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I read history at university, and that is my subject. I love historical, mainly historical biography. My main specialised period were the Tudors, and my specialised Tudor figure was Mary, Queen of Scots. Anything about that fascinating woman, I would like to curl up with her. But my taste now is anything historical. It needn't be about people. It can be about events. It can be about countries, all kinds of things. But in a historical context, that's what I enjoy.
The first stage of her 2-month journey towards the French court took Mary merely to Morlaix, where she was received by the Lord of Rouen, accompanied by the nobility of the country, and lodged in a Dominican convent. She was then taken to the church, where a Te Deum was sung in honour of her safe arrival, which appears to have had but a limited effect, since on her route past the town gate the drawbridge broke and fell into the river under the weight of horsemen. The Scottish lords in her suite, their natural suspicions of the foreigners unassuaged, after a week in France, immediately started to shout, "Treachery, treachery!" at which the Lord of Rouen shouted out indignantly, "No Breton was ever a traitor." However, for the few days Mary remained at Morlaix. To pacify the Scots, all the gates of the town were taken off their hinges, and the chains of the bridges were broken.
Antonia Fraser's Mary, Queen of Scots is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB1069, narrated by Colin Doran.
I'm not a great fan of fiction, strangely. Although I've recorded a lot of fiction stories, I don't get a great buzz out of curling up with a book of fiction. Maybe, I'm so old-fashioned, but maybe an Agatha Christie. I've read them all. I love them. I could go back to them. And the amazing thing about the Agatha Christie stories is even though you've read them all, you go back and you've forgotten who did it. You can read them a second time and still not know till the end who did it. They're wonderful.
Poirot or Miss Marple?
Oh, Poirot. Poirot is best, yes.
I think you were in Murder on the Orient Express recently.
Yes, I was. I was Johnny Depp's manservant, which was fun. We all had a great deal of fun on it. It was a lovely company. We played games all the time, and it was smashing. Once you got over the size of Ken's moustache, it was all wonderful.
And here is Kenneth Branagh narrating Murder on the Orient Express by Agatha Christie, which is TB702317.
It was 5 o'clock on a winter's morning in Syria. Alongside the platform at Aleppo stood the train grandly designated in railway guides as the Taurus Express. It consisted of a kitchen and dining car, a sleeping car and 2 local coaches. By the step leading up into the sleeping car stood a young French lieutenant, resplendent in uniform, conversing with a small, lean man, muffled up to the ears, of whom nothing was visible but a pink-tipped nose and the 2 points of an upward-curled moustache. It was freezingly cold, and this job of seeing off a distinguished stranger was not one to be envied, but Lieutenant Dubosc performed his part manfully. Graceful phrases fell from his lips in polished French. Not that he knew what it was all about. There had been rumours, of course, as there always were in such cases. The general, his general's, temper had grown worse and worse, and then there had come this Belgian stranger. All the way from England, it seemed. There had been a week of curious tensity, and then certain things had happened. A very distinguished officer had committed suicide. Another had resigned. Anxious faces had suddenly lost their anxiety. Certain military precautions were relaxed. And the general, Lieutenant Dubosc's own particular general, had suddenly looked 10 years younger. Dubosc had overheard part of a conversation between him and the stranger. "You have saved us, mon cher," said the general emotionally, his great white moustache trembling as he spoke. "You have saved the honour of the French army. You have averted much bloodshed. How can I thank you for acceding to my request to have come so far?" To which the stranger, by name Monsieur Hercule Poirot, had made a fitting reply, including the phrase, "But indeed do I not remember that once you saved my life?"
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend for the Read On listeners' Christmas stocking?
It's a Christmas stocking book, absolutely. I'm halfway through it, and it's very amusing. You wouldn't think it was amusing because it's all about punctuation. It's by Giles Brandreth, and it's called Have You Eaten Grandma? It's all about punctuation, as I say. So the title, when you realise there shall be a comma after eaten. Have you eaten, Grandma? But the title is Have You Eaten, Grandma? Because it's unpunctuated. But it's full of those lovely things, and I think it will be a wonderful stocking filler.
The explosion of social media in our time has had a discombobulating effect on the way we use language. President Donald Trump's preferred means of communication is the tweet, and his favorite form of punctuation is the exclamation mark. Last year alone, in his tweets, he used 3,660 of them. And as well as saying weird things in weird ways, "Sorry, losers and haters, but my IQ is one of the highest, and you all know it. Please don't feel so stupid or insecure. It's not your fault." The American president has come up with some weird words of his own. When on Twitter he declared, "We're going to win bigly," a new word was born. I thought he meant bigly as in hugely, or ginormously, or even supercalifragilisticexpialidociously. But no, bigly was Trump's Twitter shorthand for big league. I'm not against Twitter. I'm on Twitter myself. To get in touch, you'll find me at GilesB1. That's at GYLESB1. And I know that Jack Dorsey, the boss of Twitter, takes his responsibilities seriously. He tweeted recently, "We're committing Twitter to help increase the collective health, openness and civility of public conversation, and to hold ourselves publicly accountable towards progress." Unsurprisingly, that tweet earned him a bad grammar award from a national magazine that cares about words and language. But Jack's heart is in the right place, and he's worth $4.6 billion. So what does he care?
Have You Eaten, Grandma?, written and narrated by Giles Brandreth, is available for sale in print, audio and ebook wherever you buy your books.
So Derek Jacobi, thank you so much for being a guest on RNIB Connect Radio and for sharing your obvious love of books.
My very great pleasure.
Thanks once again to Derek Jacobi. Don't forget you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to all of you who've been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or simply go to audioboom.com and search for RNIB Talking Books. You can find both producer Robert and me on Twitter. I'm at redsail, or one word, that's redsezell, and Robert is at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.